The courier, hopping from one foot to the other, had barely let the captain say his say to the end. Now he took Joseph by the hand, manifestly panting, and ran down with him from the tower, through the court and passages of Zawi Ray, to the boat. They leaped aboard, and off it went, flying. And as it flitted and flew, Joseph, in the little pavilion on the after-deck, was shaved, rouged, and dressed while listening to the winged one's tale of what had happened at On, City of the Sun, and why he had been sent for. The thing was, Pharaoh had actually dreamed, and most portentously. But when the dream interpreters were summoned, they had failed to give satisfaction, and had fallen into disfavor. In the ensuing embarrassment, the chief butler, Nefer Emwese, had spoken up and mentioned him, that is, Joseph, saying that if anybody could help out, perhaps he could. They might at least try it. What Pharaoh had actually dreamed, that the courier could not say, save in an obviously distorted and confused version which had seeped through to the court from the council chamber where the sages had suffered their discomfiture. The majesty of this god, it was said, had dreamed first that 7 cows ate 7 ears of corn, and second, that 7 cows had been eaten by 7 ears of corn. In short, a pack of nonsense such as occurs to nobody, even in a dream. Yet it was of some use to Joseph on his way, and his thoughts played about mental images of hunger and food, of need and supply, of light and darkness. What had really happened, leading up to the summoning of Joseph, was this. The year before, towards the end of the 2nd year Joseph spent in the prison, Amenhotpe, the 4th of his name, was 16 years old, and ceased to be a minor. The regency of Ti, his mother, came to an end, and the government of the 2 lands passed automatically to the successor of Nebmare the Magnificent. Thus ended a situation which the people and all those concerned had seen in the sign of the early morning sun, the young day born of the night, when the shining sun is as yet more sun than man, still belongs to the mother, and is her fledgling, before he soars to the full height and strength of midday. Then Eset, the mother, withdraws, and yields up her sovereignty, although the maternal dignity still remains to her, the dignity of the source and fount of life and power, and always is the man her son. She gives over the power to him, but he exerts it for her, as she exerted it for him. Ti, the mother goddess, who had been ruling and guarding the life of the land since the years when her husband fell prey to the aging of Re, now removed from her chin the braided Usir beard, which, like Hatshepsut, Pharaoh with the breasts, she had been wearing, and surrendered it to the young son of the sun, whom it became almost as oddly when on occasions of high ceremony he assumed it. On such he was obliged to appear with a tail, that is, to fasten a jackal's tail to his apron at the back. This animal attribute belonged to the strict and primitive ceremonial costume of His Majesty, and still formed an item in the sacred and jealously preserved ritual, though nobody any longer knew why it was there. However, they did know at court that young Pharaoh hated it. Wearing it even had a bad effect on his digestion, inclined His Majesty to feel quite sick, and made him look pale or even green in the face. Though, frankly speaking, even without the tail, that was a feature of the attacks to which his health was subject. Unless all observers erred, the shifting of the royal power from the mother to the son had been accompanied by much misgiving. Would not one do better to put it off, or void it altogether, leaving the young son under the shelter of the mother's wing for good and all? The mother of the god herself entertained these doubts. Her chief counselors had them, and a mighty man of our acquaintance, Becknekons, sought to feed and further them. Becknekons of the strict observance, great prophet and first priest of Amun. He had not, strictly speaking, been a servant of the crown, or, as many of his predecessors had done, united the office of high priest with that of the head of the administration of the 2 lands. King Nebmare, Amenhotep III, had seen himself called upon to separate the spiritual from the secular arm, and set up laymen as viziers of the north and the south. But as the mouth of the imperial god, Bekneconz had a right to the ear of the regent, and she lent it to him graciously, though aware that it was to the voice of political rivalry that she lent it. She had had a decided share in her husband's decision to separate the two functions, and in that way to achieve the necessary result of damming back the weight of the College of Karnak and preventing a preponderance of power which, and not only since yesterday, had been a threat to the royal house. It had inherited the problem from early days. Tutmosa, Meni's great-grandfather, had dreamed his promised dream at the feet of the Sphinx and freed her from the sand. Naming as his father the lord of the prehistoric giant statue, Harmachis Kepere Atum Re, to whom he owed his crown. But this, as everybody understood, and as Joseph too had learned to understand, was nothing but the hieroglyphic circumscription of the very same position, the religious formulation of political self-assertion. And it escaped nobody that this fresh definition of Aton as a new constellation in the firmament, a process begun back at the court of the son of Tutmosa, and dwelt on so lovingly in his little grandson's thoughts, had as its aim to prise Amun-Re loose from his arbitrary and despotic union with the sun, to which he owed his universal character, and reduce him to the rank of a local power, as the city god of Wese, which he had been before his political coup. We fail to recognize the indivisibility of the world when we think of religion and politics as fundamentally separate fields which neither have nor should have anything to do with each other, to the extent even that the one should be devalued and exposed as false if any trace of the other were to be found in it. For the truth is that they change but the garment, as Ishtar and Tammuz wear the veil by turns, and it is the whole that speaks when one speaks the language of the other. And it speaks besides in other tongues, for instance, through the works of Ptah, the creations of taste, skill, and love of ornament. For to consider these as things apart, quite outside world indivisibility, and having nothing to do with either religion or politics, would be equally foolish. Joseph knew that young Pharaoh, on his own initiative, without any maternal prompting, devoted the most zealous, even jealous attention to the fostering of beauty and ornament in his world, in intimate connection with the effort he made to think into existence the god Aton in all his purity and truth. He cherished surprising ideas of change, of relaxation of the conservative tradition, feeling sure that his dearly loved god would have it so. The cause lay close to his heart. He fostered it for its own sake, in accordance with his convictions about what was true and pleasing in the world of form. But had it, on that account, nothing to do with religion and politics?